නමෝ තස්ස භගවතු අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්ධස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතු අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්ධස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතු අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්ධස්ස අපාරුතාතේ සංගමතස ද්වාරා ඤේසුතුමන්තෝ පමුංචන්තු සදාන්ති In the quiet and unassuming rhythm of the breath, we can discern the rhythms of the universe, the rhythms of time. The natural cycle that characterizes all of what we call existence. On a cosmic level, we know that the universe starts out as a constricted, compacted thing and then explodes and expands, and then after a while it contracts again, comes back in. And so that expansion and contraction of the universe is like a breath. That's one breath of the universe. Expanding, filling up the creative phase, and then the dissolution, the collapse. Similarly, if we look at the things, more immediate things in our environment. We even look, say, at a rock. A rock is sitting out there in the sun, in the bush here at Santi Monastery. When the sun heats it, the rock expands ever so slightly. And then in the night time with the cool, it contracts again. So again, in that rhythm of expansion and contraction, we can discern the same pattern that's happening to us when we're breathing. A similar thing happens, of course, with the plants. Responding or coming alive when the sun hits them, sometimes very obvious ways, like the flowers that will open up when the sun comes and then close up in the evening time. And again, we can discern that opening up, filling with space, filling with air, filling with light. And then the closing down, the dark, the closed, the withdrawal phase. So everything has these cycles. Also, compare with the cycle of the seasons, the summertime and the airy and light and warm, and then in the winter time, the cool and everything closed down, huddled together, dark, damp. And our life is this. Cycles, the interrelationship, interconnection between these cycles happening in different ways, in different dimensions, and this is precisely what we call time. And time is a concept that we use to rationalize and make sense of these different cycles. If we try to imagine a world where these things didn't happen, where there was like this continuity, where there's just, for example, a continual sun all the time, no heavenly bodies moving in the sky, no different seasons, no day and night, and so on and so forth. This is be almost incomprehensible what kind of world that would be. And certainly whether we could be conscious at all, but we could certainly, how we were conscious would be very, very different. And so since these cycles are time, they are also death. In Pali, the very kind of revealing idiom, kalankaroti, one makes the time, and that's what it means to die. One Kalamakasi, he completed his time, he made his time, i.e. he died. So this breath is life, and it's also death. And life and death being, of course, nothing more than yet another example of this kind of cyclical motions and patterns that we discern in all kinds of existence. And so in one sense, it seems almost a bit, if we look at it from this way, it's almost a bit bit depressing. We can, you know, we can see the interplay of these kind of dualities, these cycles, forming the whole universe. We can see this kind of creative force happening all around us. We can see the energy of life in everything that exists. We can see how those same truths are embodied in a little ant that crawls into my kuti in the middle of the day, and the same truth applies in a very abstract way to, just as an example, to the economy. The economy also has its summer and its winter, has its boom and its bust. This is one thing I learnt at high school about economies, is that if you have a boom, you're going to have a bust. Everybody knows that. And yet somehow we think that we're going to have a summer forever in the economy and that you're not going to have a bust that follows. But the economy also follows these natural cycles. And so wherever we look, we see these same things happening. And so, on the one hand, when there's a discovery of these things, there's a sense of wonder. There's like a tremendous sense of amazement that these patterns can be shared among all of existence, and that we too, in our most intimate sense, share the same nature as anything else we might look at. And so when we look at it in this way, we impressed and almost overwhelmed with the sense of the oneness and the beauty and the wonder of the universe. And this is a beauty which is not a trivial beauty. What we often mistakenly think beauty is catching something at just the right moment so that we can see only the good bits and not see the flaws of something. So, you know, we look at photographs or something like that, you know, we try to photograph somebody so that they look their best, and we touch up the bits that don't look so good or whatever. And that's what we think beauty is. But this is a very different kind of beauty to that. It's not that kind of beauty that comes from just with a lot of effort and a lot of work it takes to shave off, cut out, amputate life and just keep one kind of frozen, abstract, isolated moment. This is not that kind of beauty that we're thinking of. The beauty here is the beauty of understanding the totality of these things, and understanding the depth of intimacy between life and death, between happiness and sadness, between comedy and tragedy. And so this is, that kind of appreciation really lies at the base of kind of true creative and artistic endeavors, that they are in some way capturing or submitting to this reality, this way of seeing reality. But as wonderful as that is, and as awe-inspiring as that is, and as humbling as that is, it still is, at the end of the day, a bit boring. And this is an interesting remark. Stuck out. I was recently been reading Joseph Campbell talking about mythology, and he's remarking about Kali, the great goddess of time and death and rebirth in Hindu Hindu kind of mythic myths and iconography and so on. And he sort of remarks about how she's this kind of awesome figure who sort of encompasses these vast paradoxes and brings them all within her, and has got this kind of awe-inspiring power. And yet, at the end of the day, it's all a bit boring because she just keeps on doing the same thing over and over again. You keep on procreating and then killing. Sex and death, round and round and round it goes. And as powerful as that may be, and as awe-inspiring as it may be, it basically, that's all there is to it. Birth and death. Going round and round. But there's this other sense of time which seems to have some kind of direction in it. And so this purely cyclic vision of things going round and round and not ever changing needs to be complemented with another dimension that has like an arrow in it, an arrow in time. So of course this is kind of what we're used to, isn't it? We're kind of used to the idea of time moving on historical time moves on and changes. It doesn't always stay the same. The facts of our lives differ from day to day. One day is different from the next day, even though the patterns of it remain similar. But the actual facts of it, the details change, and we're used to seeing history as an evolution. Societies and so on evolving, technologies evolving, sciences evolving. We understand about the evolution of species, that species have evolved from one-celled organisms up to the highest outcome of evolution, which is of course Richard Dawkins, as the emergence of the model for future humankind, or perhaps not, but anyway. So there's that kind of direction. We see a direction in our own lives as well, don't we? We know that we've changed since we're children. And there's something meaningful about that, that we can't dismiss, in a sense that there's something irreducible, even though we can understand, well, in terms of rebirth, that we go through this cycle again and again and again. And that's true. We're born and we get old and we die. This happens again and again and again. And those patterns are the same. But on the other hand, it's also an irreducible fact that now I know more than I did when I was a kid. And I know about things in a different way. And I can't like the same things that I did when I was a kid. I can't imagine in the same way that I did when I was a kid. I can't do the same things that I did when I was a kid. And when I was then, I couldn't do the things that I do now. So there's a sense in which that has direction, and there's a sense in which that direction is or can be a growth. And we've certainly become used to the idea of seeing of progress in our society and our technology and so on. And we notice that it's very common, it's very normal that, and very understandable that we like to complain about progress. And I think probably everyone who has got interested in Buddhism would probably be, the very fact that we're interested in Buddhism tells us that we're looking to the past for some kind of wisdom, and that suggests that perhaps some people in the past knew some things which we've forgotten today. And so we have this tendency to look back and think of the past as a golden age. We sort of view it through rose-tinted glasses. But of course, when we look, for example, in the Buddhist scriptures, they also look back at the past as being a golden age. So we look back at the age of the Buddha as being the golden age, but even in the days of the Buddha, they were looking back at the previous times as being the golden age. So this suggests that rather than being an actual golden age of the past, that it's more a tendency of humanity to look back at things in this way. Perhaps this is related to our simple psychology, that when we're young, when we're babies and children, the world is basically pretty benign for us. We're fed whenever we want it, we get to sleep whenever we want to, we don't have to do anything we don't want to do, and we're kept in a nice, comfortable environment. And so we kind of project back to imagining that in the past things were also like this, and that evil was something that came into our lives after the time of bliss spent in the garden. So that may be one aspect or one dimension of these things. In terms of history, it's not easy to say whether things have actually got better or worse. As a general principle, I would agree with the idea expressed by Ken Wilber that what happens over time is that not necessarily people get better or worse, but that their capacity to do good or bad increases, and so that our power to do more greater good or greater evil increases, and what we choose to do with that is up to us. There does seem to be some evidence collected by Steven Pinker that suggests that over the years humanity has become much less violent than they were in the past. And this happens both in the short term over a period of decades, in the medium term over a period of centuries, and in the long term over a period of millennia. That it seems that the incidence of violence and violent death has dramatically decreased over these periods of time, which is good news. And so if we take that seriously, then it suggests that this arrow in time is actually moving in somewhat of a good direction, which is quite nice. But I don't want to make too much of that here. I don't want to insist on that particular detail, but just to suggest that as well as thinking about things in this kind of cyclic idea, but also there is a sense of progression, a direction with a goal or with an ending. And of course that idea is essential, or is the very nub of the Buddha's insight and the nature of the Buddha's awakening. What is there, as the Buddha set out on the Arya Pariyesana, the Noble Quest, what is there that goes beyond birth, aging and death? You know, why should I, who am subject to birth, subject to aging, subject to death, subject to defilement, subject to suffering, why should I seek that which is also subject to birth, subject to aging, subject to death, subject to defilement, subject to suffering? Why shouldn't I seek for the unborn, the unaging, the undying, the undefiled, the free from suffering, the Nibbana? And so this is, from a Buddhist perspective, this is how we see the Buddha's awakening was like this eruption or explosion out of that cycle, out of that enclosed world, and depicted in a very sweet way with the simile of the chicks breaking out of the egg. And again, you know, that idea of the egg we're contained within, like the egg in ancient Hindu times, ever since the Rig Veda. They talked about the Hiranyagarbha, like the golden embryo, the golden egg. And this was like a symbol for the origin of the cosmos, later identified with the sun. But that egg is like the cosmic, the contained cosmic cycle, which contains everything within that limit. And now the Buddha has broken out of the shell, emerged into that world of freedom. And so these two dimensions, the one aspect of the world that we're immersed in is these cycles of night and day, good and bad, hot and cold, male and female, summer and winter, all these dualities which keep on rolling around, and which beguiling and bewitching as they are, ultimately don't get anywhere. Like a kind of a merry-go-round in the fairground. You're just sort of on this merry-go-round and everything's dazzling and everything's wonderful, and you're kind of spinning around and around, you know, going on your horsey or on your whatever it may be, your little carriage or something, and you spin around and round and it goes up and down and you never get anywhere. Or again, like a simile of a yo-yo. And so this was always, Ajahn Jayasaro used to say, was the how he would translate Putujana, an unenlightened person in Pali, he would translate it as a yo-yo, because you're always spinning round and round and going up and down and never getting anywhere. But yet there's this also this direction, there is this actual getting somewhere, and the getting somewhere is obviously getting to Nibbana as a state which is in some way different from where we're at now. That movement. And this is of course something which is very controverted in Buddhism. Like, is Nibbana, you know, how can we think of Nibbana as a separate thing, a place that we're going to go to? And, you know, there are places where the Buddha used quite vivid language, vivid, very concrete language to talk about Nibbana. He called it a disa, a direction. He called it a tana, a place. He called it a pada, is a state. Or an ayatana, is like a field. All these kind of words have a concreteness to them, and yet also talking in a way that was very undermining such things as well. And so no matter, it was a problem with Nibbana is you can never conceptualize it. So whenever we try to, you know, we look at the way that academics have studied and scholars have studied and put forward about Nibbana, then every time they try to say something about it positively, then there's always another perspective, so you can always come and refute that from the other side. And this, of course, was also Nagarjuna's great critique of the early Buddhist conception of Nibbana as a Sabhava Dhamma. So according to the Sarvastivadins and a belief shared in common with the Theravadins and others was that Nibbana was a Sabhava Dhamma. That means a Dhamma which really, truly, woolly existed. And Nagarjuna came along and basically kind of demolished that idea. But it's interesting that he did not say Nibbana is the same as Samsara, which a lot of people these days attribute to him, but the actual statements that he made are much more nuanced than that and actually deserve some very careful and contextual attention. But what he said was something like that there is no visesa between Nibbana and Samsara. So visesa is a distinction. And so what that means in the context of Nagarjuna is that if you try to say there's this particular quality or particular aspect or something by which we can clearly and absolutely and totally forever distinguish between Nibbana and Samsara, then you can't find one. Okay? And this is something which is well known from, you know, if you look into any kind of study about these things, just for example, the study of what differentiates humans from animals. Okay? On one hand, it seems very obvious, doesn't it? We all know what a human is. We all know what an animal, and we can see that there's this tremendous gap between being human and being animal. But as soon as we try to pin that down to something, we say the difference is intelligence. Well, how do we measure intelligence? We say the difference is language. We say, well, what's language? How do we investigate that? And the difference is consciousness. We say, well, how do we measure whether animals are conscious? And so on and so forth. And so as soon as we try to find that visesa, it keeps on breaking down and we can never determine and settle that with any absoluteness. So this is what Nagarjuna was saying when we try to define the difference between Nibbana and Samsara. And the other statement which he made, which is also quite interesting, is that the first point of Samsara would be the first point of Nibbana, Nipubbakoti, right? So this Pubbakoti, of course, doesn't exist. Is the first point of, there is no first point of Samsara that the Buddha said, or it's, rather the Buddha said, again, this philosophical subtlety with which the Buddha put things, but he said that the first point is unknowable. So the first point of samsara, it's not to be known, it's not something which is within the ken of consciousness. And so we can never know what that first point is. All we can know is the first point that we know. We can't know what is or isn't before that. And so the first point of nibbana would be the first point of samsara, something like that. So it's a kind of optative construction here. If there was a first point of nibbana, it would be the same as the first point of samsara. In other words, you have to suffer first before you can realize nibbana. If there isn't any samsara, then there wouldn't be any beings to suffer. There wouldn't be anybody to understand the Four Noble Truths and to practice them, and there wouldn't be anybody to realize nibbana. And so this is this directionality where we have this idea that here we are suffering, we practice this path, and then we get to a place of no suffering. It's like a very simple metaphor. And so this idea of Nagarjuna is then problematizing the simplicity of that metaphor. Which is not, it's important to understand what he's doing here. He's not saying that it's not true. He's not saying that that's not, you know, how we should be understanding things and practicing it. He's simply saying that we shouldn't insist on this as a complete and total and final description which exactly matches the existing things in the real world. That's all. So we shouldn't overstate what he's actually trying to do there. So when we come back to bringing this all back to doing breath meditation, you can see that our breath meditation embodies these two aspects of time quite nicely. On the one hand, the breathing in and breathing out, so that rhythm which just keeps on going, and that rhythm which measures our life, measures our death, just the same way as the rhythm of the sun measures the life of a rock. Even that rock, remember I referred to earlier, sitting in the sun, that rock will be destroyed by that movement. The sun heats it, it expands, it contracts. Even if there wasn't any wind or any rain or anything like that, just that movement, in and out, in and out, in and out, eventually would destroy that rock and reduce it to dust. That's how powerful this rhythm of time is, this inexorable on and on and on and on and on. And so as we're breathing, we should be aware that every breath brings us closer to our death. Every breath could be our last. We're breathing in, maybe we're not going to breathe out. Breathing out, maybe I'm not going to breathe in again. Breathing in, maybe I'm not going to get to breathe out. Breathing out, maybe I'm not going to get to breathe in again. That's how quickly death happens between one breath and the next. Death always happens like that. There's nobody ever who has not died, who has not died in that way. Between one breath and the other, the breath went in and it didn't go out again, or it went out and it didn't come in again. And that's it. That's how we're all going to die. And so within our lifespan, that cycle encompasses this direction that we're moving, some spiritual direction. What are we doing with our life? How are we growing in our spiritual development in this life? We also see the directionality of that within the meditation itself. We start out at the meditation, watching this breath, watching this cycle, and as the meditation proceeds, the mind becomes more subtle, more refined, the awareness becomes purified, the hindrances drop away, the endless train of thinking starts to quieten down, and we see the kind of the brightness, the calm, the joy with the mind. And that directionality then proceeds through the whole of the stages of breath meditation, through the development of the different kinds of rapture and joy and tranquility and concentration and so on and so forth, and comes to the final tetrad, anicca anupassi viharati. One dwells contemplating impermanence in the breath, the anicca of the breath, the changingness of the breath, those cycles of coming in and out, in and out, in and out, but then the changes over time as the breath becomes more and more purified. And also the uncertainty of that. One of the meanings of anicca is uncertainty. And maybe not. Maybe it's not going to happen. Maybe one day you'll be meditating and then that will be it. It will finish. And so that impermanence is happening within that breath. And this is the insight. The depth of that insight is what leads to Patinisaganupasi asasisamidisikati. One trains oneself relinquishing everything. And so this relinquishing at the end of the Anapanasati tetrads, the 16 steps, is nothing less than the sabupadipati nisaga, the relinquishment of all attachments, graspings, belongings, stuff, the upadhi. It's the stuff, relinquishment of all stuff, i.e. nibbana. And so in that sense, the breath meditation has a one-way direction. So even though each time we sit down, we see the cycle of the breath coming in and out, that rhythm. And we also see the rhythm over the whole period of the meditation, even though each meditation is different, but still we can see a pattern where it starts out more restless, usually, and then becomes gradually more peaceful. And that process deepens over time and comes to a culmination, it comes to a fulfillment, and that fulfillment is in the letting go of all stuff, the letting go of all belongings, the letting go of all acquisitions, the letting go of all pillows. Actually, literally what pillows means is, what upadhi means is, it's one of the words used for a pillow, the things that you lean on, things that you support you. And so in that sense, when that happens, then one breaks out of the cycles of time. And that one breaks out of the dominion of the goddess Kali, who's kept us trapped for so long. You see, Kali is the female incarnation, the male incarnation is Mahakala, the black demon, which is around the 12 links of dependent origination. You can see in the Tibetan tankas with the cycle of dependent origination. And it's all contained within this kind of black, gory demon. And of course that's Mahakala, so it's the male symbol of time. The female symbol in the Hindu circles is the Kali. And so this is where we break out. And you can see in that symbolism of the wheel of life, the Arahant is standing to one side, outside of that whole wheel, outside of the grasp of Mahakala. So this is my little talk for you on this evening on breath meditation, time, and breaking out of the cycle, like chicks breaking out of an egg. So I offer this to you for your reflection, and I'd like to invite any comments or questions. Okay, that's for you. Thank you.